This is an emotionally divisive podcast. Some of you might get offended. Just their context, there was a moment where he walked into a boardroom frustrated with the way they were doing things. And he brought in, he found out that you can have an inanimate object as a proxy, I don't know if the right terminology, that can actually be a part of the meeting. And so he brought a blow-up sex doll, which is a good way to make a point, very memorable. And there's other things around, you know, how to bring authenticity into a working environment, how to help businesses be aware of the purpose that they're helping contribute to. But I think most importantly, this is a lesson on irrespective of the way a person approaches life or views the world, you should always have a curiosity, an empathy, an understanding of why they think that the way that they do and how they came to those conclusions. And that arguably is probably the most valuable thing that I've developed over time, is to find a way to learn from every person I meet. There's a lot to take away from this one. So listen with an open mind. And I'm curious what you think, so leave a review. And yeah, we'll kick into it. Anytime I start a podcast, I like to set the scene and take context of sort of who we're talking to. So a bit of putting you on the spot, but how would you sort of encapsulate your journey either in business or in life that will give people a sense of who you are?
I'm a challenger. Yeah. I'm a rebel. I'm memorable for taking the piss in all sorts of things. So, for example, my first encounter of taking the piss was my first job, which was at a Big Four accounting firm, where I was determined not to wear shoes nor wear a suit. Didn't quite fit in. And they bought me a tie. I used it as a trouser belt. They bought me some shoes. I cut the toes out of them. Those sorts of pointless things. I was an A-grade student, so I know how to work. And the way it works in most professions is if you're an A-grade student, the Big Four will hire you. And that means they get absolutely no diversity of thought. They get a vanilla milkshake every day. And then they got me. And I lasted only about 14 months. And my defining moment for being removed from the firm was when I chained my bicycle to the managing partner's car because they wouldn't give me a car park. And he said, "You don't need a car park. You haven't got a car." I said, "I know, but I'll lease it out." He then ran my bike over, ripped the mudguard off his car, and was sufficiently pissed that time was up.
Well, I'm curious, like, because that... like before the start, we talked about the power of network and yep. exchanging knowledge to develop that network. And in a sense, that sounds, that combative, rebellious side sounds like it could come at the expense of networking.
It does. It effectively means you filter, right? So obviously you can connect to people in multiple ways, and you need to sort people out from whom you want to network with to whom you don't want to network with. And nearer the end of my journey, I sit back and say, well, I'm pretty sure when I'm being buried, hopefully with an open casket at the memorial, perhaps in St. Matthew's in the city, the church will be full and they will divide into two sides. There'll be the left side that will come up with a little tear in their eye and drop a rose petal on me. And there will be others that will come up with a steely glance, look at it and say, "Thank Christ he's dead." And all I need to be able to say as I float around the rafters is everyone's on the right side of the church. So you're going to break some eggs, and if you break the eggs, it probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think there's an important realization around there. There's a guy, I don't know if you know him, he's American, Russell Brunson, and he's very talented at conversions online. He built a company called ClickFunnels, and he talks about creating the attractive character, and the attractive character isn't always nice. They're actually polarizing, and they have some vulnerabilities and deficiencies that make them relatable to people's problems. So I think I often see that, especially on LinkedIn and content like that, where people try to put their best foot forward instead of their real foot forward.
Have you read any of my LinkedIn posts? okay.
yeah, okay. What are you...
I just put an authentic.
Yeah, why? You scream authenticity.
Well, the point is, one of Gilligan Shepherd, the accounting firm I founded's core values is freedom to be real. Now, how we translate that is you can come to work as your true self, however you want to come to work. You can express yourself however you want to express yourself. You can tell anyone to fuck off if you're in a bad mood, okay? Because you need to be you. You need to bring the real you to everything you do, because if you don't, no one can trust you, okay? And the only way you have the freedom to be real is that people trust you. And they only trust you if you're authentic and you do what you say. And you're consistent.
Mm.
So I will consistently challenge. I will consistently call people out on stupid ideas with a view to them testing stupid ideas and either me learning that it wasn't so stupid or them learning that there might be a better way. So our mantra is we tell people what we think, not what we think they want to hear.
Mm. There's a few things interesting to unpack there, because one is, how do you define who you are? You know, some things are defense mechanisms. Some things might just be you in a strong emotional state where you're projecting. So how do you discover what your true authentic self is and navigate that with empathy? Because sometimes my true self might be a certain emotion in a certain moment, though the person in front of me might not feel comfortable to receive it in that way.
So I think the answer to that is everyone travels a journey down some rapids, and sometimes the water's calm and sometimes it's not. And in different contexts and environments, you react in different ways, and you will probably react consistently in each of the states you find yourself in. If you're in an emotional state, or you're a stressed state, or you are in a challenging state, or you're in a playful state, you'll probably play to your true self in each state. Okay? So no one is consistent across all environments in which they operate. No one is.
No.
Okay. So the patterns of behavior then become, like people say, when Bruce is in a bad day, he's really bad. And when he's in a good day, he's really good. And accordingly, you bring different behaviors to different contexts. The issue is you need to be consistent. Or, sorry, just be you, whether you're consistent or not. So sometimes in negotiations, I have found that the best way to get a result is to increase everybody's risk. And the best way to create or increase everybody's risk is to provide complete insane uncertainty. So I can be completely erratic to get a deal.
So in a sense, that's a conscious way to communicate to get a positive outcome.
Yeah.
So how do you dance between being conscious of how you will communicate to get a positive outcome while still being real?
By being conscious, right?
Mm.
But another point I often make, in order for you to be authentic, okay, authentic, and for that matter, in order for you to have true freedom, you have to get to the point of not giving a fuck, okay? Because if you care about something, and in particular care about how other people react to you, you will inevitably play to them. You will play to what they need or what they want. You won't play to what you are. So I don't care too much what people think of me.
Yeah, I get that aura about you.
Right, so they can enjoy it, hate it. That's them. I simply am what I am, and I do what I do. I do it in my own way, but I am generally always motivated by delivering an outcome and delivering a win-win. But generally, people don't know what they want, and generally you can distill it to a common theme. The most common way I get people together when I'm playing nicely is I say, well, what is it you want on the other side? And you listen to their story and say, so you just want peace. Cool. You want peace. What gives you peace? All this noise stopping. Cool. How does it stop? I think we could make that one work. And it usually is one person sells, one person buys, and they get out of each other's hair. But often they can't get to that point. Right. And if you can't get them to that point rationally, I just go crazy and say, well, if shared purpose doesn't work, let's try fear. Let's try annoyance. Very adept at both of those things.
Mm.
And then at the end, when they're scared shitless and they're standing on the abyss, and I'm saying, I'm holding your belt, I can let go, you can fall into the abyss of darkness, or I can drag you back and we can do a deal. Which do you want? Do you want me to push you or pull you back from the cliff? I don't care, I'm agnostic, you can go over the bank, I don't give a shit. Please pull me back, let's do a deal. Perfectly adept at that too. So I can play to all those things, but you can only play to those things if you don't sweat too much how other people react to you.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a few things in that. The main thing I notice is people often try to reconfirm what they already know instead of find the truth. And if they've got a fixed viewpoint, see two people coming into a deal, if you're in essence creating a pattern interruption, you're creating something that will deviate their current rigid viewpoint and make them more malleable, and then they become impressionable once you get there. And not all people were raised with love. Some were raised with fear. Some had different mental frameworks of how they approach problems and how they respond to others. So it's interesting.
Yeah, everyone travels their own journey to an outcome at their own pace. And the art of a deal is to converge the time and outcome expectations of the parties. And the usual ingredients are the relative greed of both, the relative fear of both, and the relative tolerance to annoyance or grit in the axle of both. And when you work out what the other side really cares about fundamentally, psychologically, you will get there.
Do you find themes? Like I spent a few thousand hours with people over the age of 65 and I asked them what's important about life and why. And they said different things, but they had themes, which was like...
I'm still under 65.
But
only just.
Oh, yeah. The gold card's coming, brother. Hang in there. You'll get to the ferry for free.
Perfect.
Yeah. And they said purpose, connection, and independence. And independence could be health. It could be financial. Just not burdening others. Do you find themes in business owners or people that you come across of what truly is important for those out there that might not have as intuitive understanding of others and need a framework to sort of dig for an answer?
Look, everyone travels that journey, right? So at different stages in your life, there will be different things that are important to you, inevitably. When you're young, it can be all sorts of things, but generally it's about relative survival. Generally. Generally, as you progress through it, it's about competition because you want to succeed. And then it morphs into family and nurturing and the future. Then it morphs into something else. And there's been quite a lot of survey data on how aging takes you through a journey. For most people, when they get to age 65, they wish to believe that their life had meaning, okay, or purpose, right? And if you have a look at the little booklet I've got there, the final article on wealth is the discovery of purpose. And often you will innately have a purpose, but it won't emerge, right? So you will actually be pursuing an innate purpose that's not within your consciousness. The only way it becomes conscious is traveling the journey, and you end up with a eureka moment where you say, wow, by looking at the things I really enjoyed and the things I really hated, things I really enjoyed, I enjoyed because they were running to my sense of self and what I wanted to achieve with meaning. Then you look at the events and you say, wow, I get it. My purpose is to create stuff. I love venture capital. I love business formation. I get a real buzz out of creating something that didn't exist and see it survive and thrive. So in creating things, you have to bring people together and create relationships. So my joy is I like to create things that didn't exist before, bring people together and create connectivity between people by pursuing a common purpose. So every business I invest in is a purposeful business, right? And they'll normally say, oh, what do you mean? We just make shit, right? Okay. You make shit. So I take one, which I quite like, fire protection. We just service properties. No, you don't. You create safe environments for people to work, play, and gather. That's what you do. They can go to those places and feel safe. You are about protecting and enabling the infrastructure of human connection. Isn't that a wonderful purpose? Oh, yeah. Why didn't you say that to us 35 years ago? Because it wasn't obvious to me 35 years ago, but it is now. Or Board Pro. Okay, it's a mini Diligent. It sells SaaS software. What's our purpose? To make boards better. Why? They think they're pretty shit hot anyway. I'm yet to meet a leader who thinks they can be improved, because, you know, they generally know how to lead or they wouldn't be there, because if they can't, the followers will knife them in the back and they'll be gone, right? So you can't teach a leader how to lead. They just have to do it. And equally, most board members believe they do a good job or they wouldn't do it. Right? So giving them better software because you want to make boards better is the wrong pitch. What you're actually doing is this. Through better leadership, which is supported by better governance and better alignment between owners, boards, and leaders, being CEOs, you will create better work environments. By creating better work environments, you enable people to be happier in their work. They will feel more purposeful. They will feel more engagement. They'll feel more connected. They won't simply be at work to fill in the time to get home and cook dinner, right? They'll be there because they want to be there, and the workplaces will be happier. And suddenly, Prozac consumption will drop. You're attacking depression, right? Human engagement in the workforce is negative in New Zealand, -4. That means more people are disengaged than engaged. How does that make for a stable, just working society? Right. Your purpose is to reduce workplace depression. Oh, that's a bit of bleak. No. Go back. It is to enable better alignment between owners, governors, and leaders to create a more vibrant workplace that has purpose and meaning to the people that work in it. Right. Oh, okay. So you look at the things that businesses do, and if they can articulate a purpose, they can bring people together around that purpose. So my role is, I like creating purposeful businesses. I like creating communities around those businesses that connect through that purpose and travel a journey to doing something useful, which helps them add to their meaning book.
Yes. It's interesting. I've been experimenting with the idea of discovering purpose, and I think the most purposeful thing a person can do is to help a version of themselves in the world. So a pain that either that person experienced or witnessed, if they can alleviate that for others, is when they feel most engaged. So I'm wondering, what led to you feeling as though you want to create what led to your rebellious state, what led to a desire to help people be more purposeful?
Journey and maturity. So the rebellion, although I do enjoy the fact that I discovered the HR manager's letter to the CEO as he resigned, the last interview he did was me, and he knew I was going to be trouble because I turned up in a black singlet with mud all over me from having been flounder fishing in the harbour, sitting in their plush boardroom, dropping mud on the floor, and said, I'm an A-grade student, I'll start tomorrow, where's the employment contract? He said, doesn't work like that, you can start in a month. I said, fine, he signed me up. He then resigned, and in his resignation letter, he said, Bruce Shepherd is my gift to you.
Oh.
I was his revenge.
Yeah.
Why did I go off on that tangent? So rebellion was just the art of being rebellious. I was a teenager. Of course, well, 20-year-old, a late teenager. Of course I was rebellious. All kids are rebellious.
Were your parents overly strict? Were they free spirits? Were they conformative?
Both were alcoholics. So as a child, Dad was a rebel. He got back from World War II, became a waterside worker, led the waterfront strikes in 1951. So he was a unionist rebeller, happily stole from the waterfront, made home brew when we effectively had prohibition, set up our home as a bar, imported some one-armed bandits, poker machines, and ran a casino. He was a rebel.
Interesting. Did you, at an early age, have to grow up quickly if you have these rebellious parents that, you know, are medicating their emotions through a substance? Did you have to find either purpose to justify the challenges you were going through, or was it not challenges, it was just a way of life? Or
just a way of life. Most kids, well, they were happy drunks, not violent drunks.
Okay. Right?
They were asleep at the wheel drunks, not active drunks. And overall, when they weren't medicated, they were okay parents. Okay. But you knew just to keep out of their way. But the other problem with that is pretty hard to take friends home to a speakeasy, right? So effectively, as children, we became quite isolated and reserved, believe it or not. So effectively, when you obtain some element of pathway to independence, the reserved disappears and you overreact. I'm now free. Bugger it. I'm on a roll. Right? Let's test the boundaries and see how far I can push it. Rebellion's about establishing boundaries.
Yeah.
But it's also about challenging, and it's about changing the way things are. So when I came out of uni, everyone wore suits and ties. As soon as I got out of that environment and my scruffy wearing of suits and riding to audit clients on my bicycle in a suit stinking of sweat, they put up with it because, well, he's doing what he said he'd do. He's wearing a bloody suit. God, I wish he'd wear a better suit. I then, when we started our own shop, had no dress code. Dress however you like. Now I find everyone has no dress code. Gee, the world's changed. I initially had an instinct to get a very dapper suit with a bowler hat to go back the other way just to be rebellious, but I got over it.
Wow. Was there a turning point where, like the rebellion and isolation and having to create your own fun and then also, you know, testing boundaries and pushing the envelope and maybe some level of, it's hard to have respect for authority figures if the key components of your life was people that are asleep at the wheel. So you might, you know, why should I listen to you? I've looked after myself my whole life. Was there a turning point with purpose? Was there a turning point where you're like, does my life have meaning right now? Like, why am I doing all this? Was there a moment for that? You don't necessarily go to school accounting. Oh, can change the world.
No, but you discover things you're good at, right?
Mm.
So what are a couple of turning points? As a kid, meaning sub 15, I thought I would be a chef. In the days of celebrity chefs like Gordon Ramsay.
So creating something.
Yeah, I guess creating something. So I can cook, okay? Dad grunted at me, don't cook bloody vegetables, son. Cook the books, become an accountant.
Yeah, okay.
There's more money in cooking the books than there is in cooking veggies. And by the way, you haven't got the personality to be a Gordon Ramsay.
You probably could, to be honest. Like, you could be an entertaining watch.
Well, maybe now, but then, right?
Oh, you got ya.
And I was studying languages, which are not my forte, and I decided, well, I might have a crack at economics and accounting, and they wouldn't let me do it because I hadn't done it before, so I got all the course books out for 3 years, did them all over the school holidays, and said, this is actually quite good, and I can see things in these numbers that make sense to me. So there was a bit of a revelation moment where, oh yeah, I can understand this. I can see from the output of this some patterns and trends that tell me a story. Some say I can see stories and numbers that others can't see. Not sure that's true. But nonetheless, I had an instinct for it. And I went from not doing accounting to topping economics and accounting in sixth and seventh form and history. I enjoy history. So history and economics are a partner subject anyway. Economics and accounting are a partner subject. The only other thing I probably would have done differently at uni is I would have done some psych papers.
Mm.
Right? But you sort of learn that from doing shit. So then you leave school and you end up in university. Next wildcard eureka moment is in schools there are cliques, right? You're either in the in crowd or you're not. That's what teenagers are. And I'm not in the in crowd. I'm a geek. Right? And a reserved, quiet geek. Sure, I found something I'm good at. And I arrive at university and everyone has been taken back to ground zero. It's a leveler, right? There are no cliques anymore. No one knows anyone. It's an enormous environment. It's like being let out of the cage. And suddenly I find myself.
Then. It's interesting around being a quiet and reserved kid that was isolated not just from parents but school, and that your desire to create things, because you can't judge. It's not judging you, it's judging what you're able to create.
Mm.
So you can still be of value to others. Quite interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, How about the moment where, okay, you come in with your mud, you just got your flounder, and you're like, I'm leaving this place, I'm going to start my own thing. What happened there?
Well, there was a couple of other jobs along the way. Then I went to the Inland Revenue. That was amusing.
Yeah, enjoyable.
I stayed longer than I thought.
Okay.
Stayed 3 years there.
Yeah.
An interesting environment. Was the one place I found where it is almost a work-free environment. Almost. I got to the point where it was sufficiently comfortable. And, you know, I had more ministerial complaints than anyone else. Because I sort of thought, if I have power, I may as well use it. But I didn't always use it for the purpose for which it was designed. For which, as a result, I got ministerial complaints. Still got results.
I don't actually know what a ministerial complaint is.
It means this little bastard has made my life miserable and he did these things that were never intended to be done. And I'd like you to investigate, minister. Right? So,
okay.
So if you ever have a problem with a government department and you're not getting anywhere with the government department, what do? You will write to the minister.
Gotcha.
It's called a ministerial complaint.
Okay, thank you.
And they are really painful because they filter back down through the organisation and make people's lives miserable. Didn't make my life miserable. I just sat there with my boss and said, I have these powers. Yes, but they weren't intended for that. But I have them. But you use them for an improper purpose. But I got the result. Why do you care? So it didn't really work. And then, of course, I became the victim of the improper use of powers in a subsequent life, but that's okay.
Surely.
Oh, yes, I was a tax avoider.
I
decided that tax rates at 66% weren't that much fun, so why don't I buy tax losses? Everyone does that. I was a slow learner, so I did it again and was involved in a very large arrangement to plant Douglas fir trees, which, by the way, trees got planted, and I already owned a forest, so it seemed perfectly logical to me that I'd just have another one. Except the lawyers had structured it in such a way that it created enormous tax losses. The lawyers then thought this was such a great idea that they would do more of it, and now a big chunk of the South Island is planted in Douglas fir, and the tax losses were so enormous that they were systemically going to collapse the country. We could have systemically collapsed the entire tax base with the losses this devious bunch of lawyers were creating. I ended up on the litigation committee to defend myself from the Inland Revenue, along with a few thousand other people. And the Inland Revenue used various powers that it had in a very commercial manner. Right? In short, they used powers for a purpose for which they weren't designed. So I was a victim of my own poor behaviour in an earlier life. It is karma.
Wow. What is that actually like? I came across this guy that he owed like hundreds of thousands of dollars to them.
Mm.
And then his approach is just leave the business. I'm just going to go busk and take everything with cash. Because it just can't pay it. What is that even like? Is it awful? Could you lose your accounting background?
Of course.
Yeah.
So you have, if you are going to play in that environment, you have to always have an escape hatch, right? So you look at things like, at that same time, I had done the shareholders association thing. So I had a public profile for various theatrics, and I decided I would take those theatrics to my professional body, who were behaving, in my mind, stupidly, and they needed to not take themselves so seriously. So I took a naked blow-up rubber doll to their AGM and spent 2 hours debating with the chair why the rubber doll was eligible to be there, because I'd formed a company and appointed the rubber doll as a director and appointed the company as a proxy. Anyway, an aside. So that went on, and they just didn't see the funny side of it, right? Just didn't.
I can't imagine why.
But the worst thing I did, and it was very bad taste, is when they were refusing to let me speak, I stuck my fingers in a particular part of the said blow-up rubber doll's anatomy and held her above my head and demanded that Fifi have the right to speak in a very high-pitched voice. And I did a ventriloquist act and made my point. As a result, they decided they wanted to strike me off. Okay, so three things happened. Firstly, I'm sitting there with the Inland Revenue chasing me for a few million dollars. Fine. I've got the Institute trying to strike me off. And at the same time, my bank called up all my credit.
Hmm.
It was a bit of a clusterfuck.
Yeah.
However, you just fight your way out of it.
I've yet to meet a business owner or even a human that has...
And by the way, I didn't get struck off.
You didn't?
Oh, no, yeah. The ruling was Bruce does not have bad ethics. He just has really bad taste. Cool. I think that is an incredibly just and insightful ruling.
Yeah, well, that is a fair... Yeah. Well, So there's lots of people that... It doesn't matter who you are. There's probably going to be... Find their moments of hardship. They might not have the degree of public profile and the degree of pressure all at once financially. But
So your question is, how do you actually deal with that?
Yeah.
So firstly, you've got to visualize what your escape hatch looks like and what life looks like post the abyss. So bankruptcy is not a pleasant state, but it's not an unpleasant state either.
Mm.
If, however, you're used to consuming at the rate of $1 million a year, it will be a very unpleasant state. If you're used to consuming at $30,000 or $40,000 a year, it will not make any difference to you whatsoever. That's the first point. Second point, you say, well, what else do I care about? I can consume as I wish, so it doesn't matter. Have I got assets outside of my risk pod, which is the bankruptcy thing, that are safe? Have I got a trust? Has that trust got assets? Are my family safe? So you have to be able to compartmentalize risk. Then you sit back and say, well, okay, I can no longer be a director. Okay, doesn't matter. Someone else can be a director. Maybe my wife. Maybe my blow-up rubber doll.
Right. I was thinking that.
However,
can you make an inanimate object a director?
No, you can't.
Stitch up.
Right. But you can appoint an inanimate object as a proxy in a meeting, which is what a body corporate is, right?
Okay.
But a body corporate has to have a live, breathing director. So I did this before you had photo IDs and dates of birth. So I also pointed out that the bloody database was screwed and maybe I'm to blame for the fact that we now have all this AML stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I doubt it.
Started from the blow-up doll, yeah. Now we're here.
It could have, who knows? But you've got to have escape hatches and you've got to be able to live with the environment. So, okay, I can no longer be an accountant. Who cares? I've got three partners. I'll just work for them. Cool. Do they respect me enough and admire me enough and accept me enough to allow me to be an employee on a very small stipend? And then at the end of 3 years, I miraculously come out and become a partner again. Who cares? But you have to be able to understand what your escape hatches are and never put all your chips in one basket. It's a bit like going to the casino over the road, taking $500, sitting at the table and putting it all on red and say, spinner up. You don't do that, right? Got to have baskets.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've definitely had a varied and interesting life thus far. What would the version of you now have done differently, not in terms of what you regret, but in terms of execution from a business standpoint?
My style does sometimes burn off people I'd prefer not to. So there is collateral damage. If I examined what I cared about, which is relationships and connectivity, in the moment, and rated different people in different ways and adjusted my behavior to what I truly wanted from them, I might have achieved more. So to your very first point and mine, I don't care what people think about me, that comes with collateral damage. So even though you don't care what people think about you, in reality, you do. Everyone does. It's just a matter of degree. So sometimes I have burnt off people that it would have been better not to have. But I very rarely attract people that I regret attracting. I've had a couple, but
yeah,
not too many.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an underrated component of either professional networking or personal networking is the depth of that connection. I think one of the best compliments I ever got from a friend was that she said, you give me the permission to be myself. You know, I think there's something immensely powerful about being courageous enough to be authentic at the expense of what others might think of you and how that can either lead or inspire or encourage others to feel as though they can. What might you say to someone in that corporate environment wearing the suit, doesn't want to wear the suit, and navigating the empathy and authenticity, or being strategic with the relationships, or should you just not? And who gives a fuck?
Look, you're better not to put yourself into conflict, right? So what I say to people, and I've done a few graduate talks at Auckland and Waikato University, and I say, I know the world's different, right? I know jobs are scarce. You can either prepare a CV and scattergun it out, and that's like funnel marketing, right? Pointless, right? You'll send out 1,000 CVs, you might get 2 responses, you might get 1 interview, and then you're told to fuck off, right? What I would suggest you do is this. Identify people that you admire and trust that you want to work with. Step one. If you don't admire and trust the people you work with, you won't be happy. And you won't be safe either. Secondly, identify organizations that are doing something useful that you admire and trust. Okay. Once you've done that, do your research. Understand what that business does and what those people are. Then rock up to reception and simply say, I want to meet the CEO or the HR manager or whatever. Tell them why, that you want to work for them. When you get into the meeting, because you'll always get a meeting. You'll always get a meeting, right, if you do that. Tell them why you admire and trust them. That's smoke up their ass. Tell them what you've observed about their businesses and their conduct and their positioning in the marketplace, and try to come up with one insightful thought. Your best shot. The reality is they probably already thought of it, okay? But occasionally they won't have, and it will be a eureka moment. You will then get a job in an organization, in an environment, with people you admire and trust, doing something that you're proud to do. And then you can be your real self.
Look at that. Beautiful, even. I approach it in the same concept in a different way. The reason I got working here with Greg, though, getting a job as an advisor is pretty easy because there's no young people. But yep. I want to learn about money. So I had some money, so I was like, I'll run events and I'll attract an audience. I don't think many advisors can attract an audience, so I'll do that. And then I'll door knock businesses and ask them, hey, do you want to speak? So Greg said yes. And then from there, paid for my studies, hired me, all that sort of stuff. And I think that's an important thing, is to think of how you can add value to your ideal either client or your ideal person that you want to work with. A modern and low-hanging way to do it with LinkedIn is a lot of incredible people make content that no one cares about or engages with. If you make a list of those companies you want to be a part of and leave your valuable 2 cents in their comments consistently over a period of time, and do it in volume across lots of different people, and then think about how you could do your outreach, which is either the connection or meeting in person, because they'll be familiar with you. Not only that, everyone that sees or likes that content will see, get a notification that you commented. So it's an efficient use of your time. You're adding a meaningful connection, and they're buying into you before they're buying into your experience and that sort of thing. So we've done 42 minutes. So I'll be curious on a direction, either an idea or a topic you're exploring at the moment, a realization you're having within the business. What is something at the moment that you're fascinated by in terms of enhancing a business or enhancing your life? Or
I've been through a number of pet fetishes, right?
I hope you can explain that.
So,
Zootopia.
Yeah, so my first was politics. Okay. In short, the world is run by old men, or now old women, or now young women, who haven't got a bloody clue. How the hell am I going to shake that up? So I've done a number of political things, overtly and covertly. Right? I then worked out that that's actually pointless, right? Because politicians are fundamentally pointless. They're an annoyance, but they're pointless.
Okay.
So then I thought, I need to transform business, which is a continuing theme. Then I thought, macro, what's the problem facing New Zealand? And the problem facing New Zealand in the early 2000s was a completely dysfunctional capital market, poor capital formation, disconnection between ownership, governance and leadership. Ownership's completely disempowered. No one understands how to own things. I'm going to make that my mission. Did my 9 years with the Shareholders Association. Then I thought, near the end of that, I went back to politics. Now I've fixed governance, and I have explained to fund managers that they have a duty to vote their shares in an intelligent way. And I've explained to proxy advisors they actually need to think about what they actually advise their managed funds to do, you know, and created tension around responsible ownership. I then figured out in the late 2000s that the macroeconomic settings in New Zealand spending a dollar and earning less was going to end badly, and started championing changes to the regulatory environment. So I had that for about 4 years dealing with the FMA, right, and did my time on that. And now I sit back and say, what's the missing bit? What's the missing bit in New Zealand's capital structures? And fundamentally, the missing bit is access to private capital. You know, we look at how New Zealand finances macro stuff, be it roading, dams, big business, whatever. We only traditionally have two bulk sources of capital: state-funded capital, which is your state-owned enterprises, or foreign ownership. So what does that lead you to as a society? It leads you to a society run by a bunch of communists in Wellington, one avenue. The other avenue is a hollowed-out economy where we're all slaves to foreign masters. Yet there is domestic capital. And I thought, why is it that our private capital, family office capital, doesn't deploy and doesn't provide New Zealand-centric ownership of assets? Why is it that New Zealand's private capital doesn't engage with each other effectively? Why do they not connect together effectively? And why do they not take a transgenerational view of their wealth? Because very few of us do. And if I compare New Zealand to, say, Europe, which has a very well-developed transgenerational family office structure, America getting there, and China, private capital structures are pretty robust. It's the missing piece. Right? Hence, I thought my mission now is to transform how people think about wealth. That's my current mission. You need to think differently about wealth if New Zealand is to have a future that isn't a hollowed out, foreign owned society or a communist one. Wealth has to really get engaged, and wealth has to find purpose, not just business. If you have wealth, it's pointless. People say, well, surely I've got money. It must have point. And I'll say, have a think about that. I'll say, well, what do you mean? I'll say, well, money does nothing unless people work it. Right? You own a business, doesn't work unless you've got people working it. Everything comes back to people. So you need to understand that your wealth is an enabler of people. So work out which people you want to enable and what you want to enable them to do, and you will have purpose for your wealth. Investing it in fucking managed funds and passive investments is pointless. Sorry.
That's right, I think different.
Unless you're running a pension fund. Right? And there's an article on there, and I want to run a pension fund with a nest full of squawking chicks waiting to have worms dropped in their mouth. Fine, you know, some family offices have to run managed funds as a core capital base to feed the family, which is all great. But if you are the family member running the pension fund, you've got the most thankless, joyless task of anyone ever born. Hence, you subcontract it out to people like you.
Yeah.
But you've got to understand where your wealth sits and how it apportions out. So my mantra is I need to keep harping on to wealthy families in New Zealand. Think 100 years, not 10. Think about how your children or whatever are going to carry forward your purpose, pivoted to their own. So don't be dictatorial about that, because they probably won't have the same purpose as you. And how do you build scalable pools of capital that can come together with others that share your purpose to retake New Zealand ownership of our assets? That's our challenge. That's my pet mission now.
That's an inspiring speech. You could have got the politician route, could have worked, mate. I'm not interested in politics, but I'm interested in what creates the greatest net gain for what I'm trying to achieve. And I think you can do more outside than you can inside. So on that differentiation between Europe and New Zealand, do you think there's either an inherent shame around wealth or inherent secrecy or the tall poppy syndrome? What do you think leads to that delegation to foreign investment or to state?
There is a tall poppy syndrome in New Zealand. We celebrate sports heroes, right? We don't celebrate business heroes. We don't celebrate wealth. America does. Europe, less celebratory than America. But there is almost a shame in having accumulated wealth. Right? So I have a think about that and say, well, why is it shameful to be wealthy? Right? And I recall saying in a private meeting to Carmel Fisher, when we're debating what she spent her money on, pink Bentley, topless pink Bentley. I said, Carmel, you do know that you're just making yourself a target for ridicule. But it's my money, she says. I should be able to spend it how I like. Yeah, but others judge you. And by the way, when there is a huge disparity between the wealthy and the poor, conspicuous consumption, Maria Antoinette, will result with a pitchfork through your guts.
Yeah.
Right? So be aware that how you deal with your wealth creates resentment. So I think a big reason why we have tall poppy syndrome is the immaturity of wealthy people's attitude to wealth.
Okay, that's an interesting angle. Yeah,
because often they will make a big pile and then give it to charity. Right, I see donating copious volumes of wealth to charity as an acknowledgement of the wealth creator's failure. They look at me and say, how do you get to that? I'll say, well, you've raped, pillaged, burned and plundered, created victims all through your life. You've got to the end of your life and you feel guilt and regret, and you appease your guilt and regret by donating to charity to fix the wounds and damage you've done. Hello? It's pointless. Why do you not simply use your wealth to enable others to succeed? You get your share, they get their share. Use your wealth to make other people wealthy. They'll make you wealthy along the way.
Yeah, it's right? Interesting. Yeah.
And if you do that and you create things and you create jobs and you create opportunity and you create a dynamic business environment where things are exciting, the people will be excited. They won't resent wealth. They'll understand that wealth, when deployed purposefully to create wealth in others, is actually a useful and desirable thing. So I think the tall poppy syndrome is to a point, self-induced, but it is unhelpful.
Yeah. There's a few things. I'm a believer that humans have an inherent understanding of unfairness. By that, I mean that they did the study with monkeys with feed one cucumbers, feed one grapes. And every time they did an action, one would get grapes, the other one would get cucumbers, and it would start freaking out, getting upset. This is unfair. This is bullshit. Another concept is a study they did with zebras. You've
read Frigonomics then.
I haven't read that one.
You haven't?
I just watched a video, a TED talk about it.
Get the book out, Frigonomics. It's just gorgeous.
Okay. Well, I haven't read a book in a while, so I'll do the summary. How's that? I'll watch the summary and I'll get a Frigonomics. Another thing you talked about was around the standing out. And there was an interesting thing they did with zebras, because it makes no sense to stand out that much. But what they found is they couldn't work out what was the zebra. Like, was it this one we're studying or that one? So they started leaving marks, like a red dot or a clip. And they would find that that zebra would get killed. And it was because it wasn't so much that they are camouflaged, it's that they stand out from the rest of the herd. So there can be a concerted effort to attack them. And I think there's something about that inherent feeling of unfairness, as well as someone to focus on and direct that feeling of unfairness. And if you're lavishly showing off that wealth or done it in an unfair means, then I can see why that would contribute to that narrative.
But remember, standing out can often be conditioned among humans. So among humans, we can choose who stands out and who doesn't, and who should be a victim and who shouldn't. And boy, do we do that well. So, within living memory of some people who are still alive, Adolf Hitler did a pretty good job of demonizing people that did not need to be demonized, right? And what are we doing today in New Zealand? Right? I am amused by David Seymour, but I do get his point around co-governance, and I do get his point around us creating a special class in New Zealand of people who happen to claim to be Maori. Right? I get that he's got a point. We're doing it in an opposite way, right? So Adolf Hitler created a class to be demonized, which is one side of the coin, saying Jews now stand out, so let's gas them, which is the zebra equivalent of eliminating them. We're doing it the opposite way. We're creating a special elite class, although they don't feel elite. They feel aggrieved, but nonetheless, we're creating an elite class, which by elimination means the rest aren't. So when you start thinking of people as sub or superior, you create divisions, and you create disharmony, and it's just wrong. It just is.
Do you think it's promoting them as superior, or promoting their problems is more important? I don't see people out there worshipping Māori. You know what I mean? Like, they're not.
Well, we all have problems, right? So when Māori say we are impoverished, I say, well, there's a big rump of white trash too, right? So you don't have that uniquely. What you have uniquely is a sense of grievance for things that happened in the past that put you on a journey to poverty that would not have been so if the journey had been different. Okay, you have that uniquely, for sure. But doesn't it, after nearly 200 years, sound a little bit like an excuse?
Geez, yeah, you're putting it out there, aren't you? What would be, okay, let's approach it from a different route. Let's say, okay, we don't need to agree.
So we've got the wealthy that have demonized, right?
Yeah.
We've got everyone but Maori that are now being demonized in New Zealand. We have same-sex couples and families being demonized because we are demolishing family in one form or another through all sorts of social interactions that we have. There's a whole lot of interesting stuff going on But none of it is fundamental to me that I'm going to get on a hobby horse about. The main hobby horse I've got is wealth needs to grow up.
Yeah. The angle I was going to go was from an empathetic standpoint. If you, let's say, there seems to be an immense humanity within you, as well as a polarizing expression of who you are, and a defiance and a rebellion. What would be an empathetic way to lift us all up, acknowledging that there might be a disparity in terms of what led them to this point, in terms of our ancestral contribution to that, or not, depending on what you feel? What would be an empathetic way to approach and to support and to improve the unfairness?
It involves both parties wearing the other party's shoes. So the only way you get to an empathetic outcome is for non-Maori to wear Maori shoes for a day and Maori to wear non-Maori shoes for a day and wear the other person's perspective. So given that I am not a Maori, I need to wear the Maori's shoes. So I think the start point is to empathy is understanding and listening and hearing. Okay. Then when you've heard it, you have to distill it to its essence, acknowledge it, reframe it subtly, and move it forward. Okay. But you can't move it forward without listening, understanding, and acceptance. But once you've got to acceptance of what happened and the journey that everyone took, everyone has to get to acceptance of the reality of today and accept that we're in this together. We're all in the same waka. Right? We're not in separate wakas. This is our country. We're all here. Short of one part of society running a killing fields operation like Cambodia, we're all here. We're all here together. We're going to have a shared journey into the future. Accepting the past, understanding it, acknowledging it, getting to acceptance of the journey, getting to acceptance of the present, and finding a common future together is the only solution. But it starts with listening. Now, I think since Jim Bolger's government, when we started on the treaty settlement process, which is a method of listening, there has been a one-way dialogue too long, I think. Hmm. I think it needs to become a two-way honest dialogue. And I think many New Zealanders are not brave enough to have a contrary dialogue. And I don't think Maori are conditioned currently to hear an alternative dialogue, which is a shame. So I don't think it's going to end well anytime soon, unfortunately.
Hmm. Is it a certain types of people in power that are Maori, as opposed to, I've met some very free thinking and open minded and compassionate Maori people, as opposed to a race in itself being malleable to open their mind. Yeah?
I think the definition goes like this. Every human is an individual unique in their own right, and they succeed on their own terms. Accordingly, success on their own terms is not race based. The concept of Maori is becoming a concept of tribe, not a concept of humans. Okay, fine, it is what it is. Best definition I have of that was what happened at my father's funeral. Okay, my father was also a double amputee from the Second World War, and he, post the war, I knew he did this, he worked in the rehabilitation clinic, helping people come to terms with serious injury. Anyway, he was also an absolute hater of everything Maori. Right? And I assumed up until his funeral that that meant he hated individual brown people. I'm at his funeral. The eulogies have been done. And a Y artist starts at the back. I'm going, this is probably the single most unexpected thing I expected to have at my father's funeral. And a Maori family came up. The husband was a double amputee like my father, both legs off. And he told the family and dad's friends how my father saved his life. Meaning he saved his life from the depression of being disabled. And it dawned on me that Dad actually was colorblind. What he hated was what was happening to our country based on the divisions that were occurring. Right? And he was blaming the other side. What he didn't do is he didn't look to self, which is, what am I doing that's digging this divide? And both need to do that.
So as a final question, because it is a divisive one.
I love being challenging.
Yeah, I sense it. Yeah, can't imagine why. You didn't bring your blow-up doll. You let me down, mate. to push back in the sense that, let's say, talking about the divisive divide, is there value in emphasizing either words that have strong emotional connotations like Māori and implications and treatment that they may have had as a result of that word? Is it worthwhile to make a generalization about that word as opposed to speak of the problem and to speak to the individuals? You know, is that not further compounding the divide?
Probably. But the just as Europeans, British, French are just labels. When I was a child, the term Maori was just a description of a journey. They were still humans. They were still just people. They were our neighbours. Right? You didn't actually see them as materially different to us. In the last 50 years, that journey has changed. That is a tragedy for me as a fourth or fifth generation New Zealander.
Okay. All right. Well, on that note, I think a person that hears or finds your unique way of approaching things and who you are, finds that interesting, or even might find other people in your organization worthwhile, and then they should reach out. Who should reach out? And why should they reach out? And where do they reach out? You know the pitch.
Want me to do a pitch?
Do a pitch.
Our perfect connection occurs with people that are passionate about what they do, are energetic, are driven, are motivated by creation, that are seeking to do something big, that actually want to create connectivity and partnerships. That's the typical value set of the best connections we have. People that actually are aspirational, we connect with well. Certainly, we also connect well with wealth families who are looking to find purpose and to actually smooth transition to their children. Our client base has quite a large number of wealthy families. When I say wealthy, they're not the billion-dollar families. They're the 20 to 80 mil pools of wealth, which are enough to ruin their children or make them. And that is the big concern they have. And the coaching around creating connectivity between what I call G1 and G2 and communicating G1's purpose to G2, but being open about it evolving and encouraging the children to remain together in a shared family endeavour is beginning to resonate with some of those clients. A lot of them are now connected to each other through common investments we've made with each other, and that has created community. So a wealthy family seeking to find community, shared purpose would probably enjoy us. Businesses that are in rapid growth would enjoy us. People with serious crises, I love fixing. I'm really good at getting people to get perspective around crisis. And once they get perspective and they no longer care what the outcome is, they generally find they win every single time. So we're good at that. And the team are pretty good at ensuring the basics are covered. And they do it in a good, open, communicative way.
Cool. Wow. Well said. Well, on that note, I'll put it in the description if they want to reach out on the website and watch your controversial LinkedIn post or engaging or whatever the laugh was behind that LinkedIn post at the start. But yeah, thanks for coming.
No problem. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did. It's interesting.